is Nicole Whitney, News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained.
Yeah, it's a great honor to have you on the show tonight. Welcome, Deepak Chopra.
Thank you.
Yes, this is...
You're listening to the News for the Soul Radio Network. The News for the Soul Radio Network airs daily, and our archives are always totally free. Go to newsforthesoul.com to join the next live show now. That's newsforthesoul.com.
Next on News for the Soul, it's time for the Whole Health Initiative with Dr. Holly. With more degrees than a thermometer, Dr. Holly's PhDs include psychology, natural medicine, herbal medicine, nutrition, and Ayurveda. She's a scientist, professional speaker, and the author of over 20 books. She also sees and works with energy, and she's here to help you achieve complete optimum health. Please welcome Dr. Holly back to News for the Soul.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Wednesday. And we've got another great day today. We're going to start with gardening, and I thought I should start altering. I don't know why I didn't think of this ages ago, but as you know, I really push gardening, not only for your own health and well-being, whether you have a house, a townhouse, a condo, an apartment, doesn't matter. We teach you what to grow so that you have nutrient-dense food without all the toxicity, and whatever you have left over, if you want to give it to the food banks, which are starving right now, pardon the pun, we will do that. But what I am thinking I should be doing, which I don't think I have done, is with each item that we talk about, how to grow, what to grow, et cetera, we should be discussing more about why that's important to your health, a particular food. I've done it a few times, I think, but who knows? Anyways, we're talking about cabbages today. So we're also going to start about talking why cabbage is so good for you. Well, for the many programs we've done over the years on pre and probiotics, so for those who don't know, prebiotics is basically fiber. Probiotics is the bacteria that we really, really need. There's over 35,000 different types of that known bacteria that could be in your gut. Each one of us has our own, just like you have your own fingerprint, you basically have your own profile of what bacteria are in you. Many of them overlap in what they do, but they provide us everything from breaking down the food that our enzymes haven't broken down to producing neuropeptides, neurotransmitters, enzymes, precursors, etc. So they're very, very important to us. The probiotic is, prebiotic is important to them because it provides them with transportation and with food. So looking at cabbage, cabbage has great pre and probiotic. It's a fantastic food. It's the prebiotic, it has both what we call soluble and non-soluble fibers. So the soluble fiber helps to regulate the blood glucose up into your body, from your gut into your body, the portal blood system, and up into your liver. The non-soluble fiber helps to regulate the flow, the transit of your stool as it's passing through your colon. So both are very important, and both are found in cabbage. Now, there's a variety of different types, and there's all kinds of vitamins and minerals, but right now we're just focusing on the pre and probiotics and the, basically the probiotics, really, but let's keep going here. There are a variety of foods in the cabbage family. You can get your red, green, and white cabbages. You can get your kohlrabi, your Napa or Chinese cabbage, your kale or leaf pack cabbage. And within each of these categories, you know that there's all kinds of other ones, your Savoy cabbage, Jersey cabbage, sorry. Bok choy, there's like over 100 types of bok choy that you can grow. We can use cabbage in its raw state, which we often do, say, in Western diets called coleslaws. We can cook cabbage either in a soup. We can make cabbage rolls with it. But we can also increase the healthy bacteria flow by fermenting cabbage. So not only do you increase the bacteria with fermentation, but you also increase enzymes, which are really important. We can use like the common Russian, I usually think of it as a Russian cabbage, is the sauerkraut, with or without the wine. You can have your sour cabbage, which basically the sour cabbage and the sauerkraut are very, very similar. It's just how they're prepared. So your sauerkraut is usually you slice or dice the cabbage, whereas in the sour cabbage you use the whole head as opposed to the leaf. We have the kimchi, which is another popular one. That's the Korean one that's very spicy and has other vegetables in it as well. The curtido is a Salvadorian fermented cabbage. It also has onions and carrots in it. But in addition to fermenting it, which increases the bacteria, we can also pickle it. Nepokle, I never know how to say that, is very, very similar to sauerkraut. Then there's the tianjin, which is a Chinese pickled cabbage. We have pickled red cabbage. If you go on to recipes for pickling cabbage, there's like recipes from every culture around the world. So take advantage of them when you've got too much in your garden just for you. I thought I should put in what's the difference between fermentation and pickling, because we'll use this for a lot of our foods that we have excess foods in the garden, whether it's asparagus or cabbage or ginger or whatever you have, we can basically pickle and or ferment it. So the difference is that fermentation uses bacteria. A common one that most people are familiar with, I don't drink, but I'm familiar with it, is hops. Hops is the plant and beer is the bacterial byproduct. So you add bacteria to the hops and you create all the different types of beer. Lactobacillus is the most commonly used type of bacteria to create fermentation in our foods. But what's really cool is that lactobacillus eats the sugar, eats the carbs, and produces the lactic acid. The lactic acid preserves the food and adds flavor. Pickling is very different than that. May seem the same, similar for some people, but pickling uses acid, vinegar or lemon juice, as opposed to bacteria. You're not creating a bacteria that's eating the sugars and the carbs. You're using acid. And it preserves food very well. And like I said, the most common one is using vinegar or lemon juice along with salt water. Both methods preserve the food, and you typically just keep them in a cool place. I always keep mine in the garage. And like I said, you can pickle and ferment a ton of different foods. So if cabbage is so common around the world, you can eat it raw or cooked, pickled or fermented. Let's find out how to grow, which is what this part of the session is all about. Now, just a minute. You can start growing, seeding your cabbage in your hothouse in a warmer area before the last frost. So number one, 1 ounce of seeds will cover 5 square yards. You usually don't need that just for a family, but if you're wanting to support other families and or the food places, then that use the whole package. They will sprout in about 4 to 10 days, do need well-drained soil and the full sun. They're kind of like tomatoes in that sense. They like lots of water. They like the water to be well-drained, and they like lots of sun. Now, if you have warmer climates, some of the cabbages aren't that keen on the warmer cabbages. They do like the cool weather, but Oriental and Savoy cabbages have an easier time in the warm areas. Cabbage, like tomatoes, we were talking about the determinate and indeterminate tomatoes last time. Cabbage can also have different production periods if you want. There's the early and mid-season varieties. They are smaller and faster growing versus the long season or late season varieties, which actually end up storing better. So I always make sure I don't just produce both or plant both. I don't produce them, but the ground does. I don't just plant both, but I plant a variety of each. Now, you'll find that the red, white, green cabbages, cabbage head, different than the leaf types of cabbage, your savoys and your bok choys and what have you. So make sure you understand the difference with what you're planting. Also, especially more so with the head cabbage, I believe, when you start to grow them, like mine are massive already, you want to spread them out. They don't like to be kept close together. Now, that is for old-style conventional-type farming. When I meant to look up to see what they said when, and we were talking 2-3 weeks ago about lettuces and how you can plant them really close together. It will force them to grow high and out, but they'll grow really thick and beautiful, intensive. Cabbage doesn't really do that as well. So mine are closer together than what they traditionally say, which is suggesting a spacing of 24 inches. I'd say mine are about 12 inches, maybe 10 to 12 inches. So I do plant them closer together than what was suggested before. Like I said, they like off the water, but they like it to kept even. So you don't want to just really, really drench them, say, on Saturday morning and leave them dry for the rest of the week. You want to water them daily. They also like lots of fertilizer. Cabbage takes an awful lot out of the ground. So even though we've talked about all the different types of manure, from your green manure that you make from your kitchen leftovers to your horse and cattle and chicken and rabbit manures, a lot of people will tell you that you need to add in, or you could add in, things like fish emulsion and seaweed. I don't do that. I do keep all the skins from fish. So we don't eat salmon because of the radiation, but we eat an awful lot. All the bones, I keep all the skins, and I feed those around the cabbages. Now, another thing about cabbage is they tend to attract what I thought historically was a beautiful white butterfly, but it's not a beautiful white butterfly. It is a horrible white moth. And it's horrible because it will leave larvae on your cabbage leaves, and then that larva turns into worms that eat all your cabbage, and golly gee whiz, you have nothing at the end of the season. A really simple way to protect your cabbage, any of the types of cabbage, is to plant mint and lavender around them. The moths don't like the mint and the lavender. So I don't plant those right into the soil. I plant them in their own pots, as we've talked before. Mint in particular, but lavender as well, can grow like a weed and take over everything. So I always keep them well contained in their own pots as opposed to planting them right into the garden beds. But I plant both mint and lavender between the cabbages, rows of cabbages, to make sure I protect them from what used to destroy my cabbage. And I go, how do I get rid of these white moths? Blah, do so much harm. Other things besides mint and lavender you can put in is onions and radishes, and for color, for flowers, if you like your flowers, is your nasturtiums. Just plant them between the rows of cabbages, we use companion growing. Grow your plant so that they protect one another. They attract the good stuff and repel the bad stuff. If you don't have those in your garden yet and you haven't planted them or don't want them for whatever reason, you can also use covers to protect your cabbages from those white moths. I don't even know what they're called. We always just call them white moths. We have the great big netting, you know, those things that you use to net butterflies. My dad walks around the yard trying to net those white guys because we really don't like them. And we have significantly less than what we used to, probably because I have now so much mint and lavender in the gardens. Another thing that you can use, not only for your cabbage, but for other plants as well, is eggshells. Eggshells are wonderful for the garden. They're full of nutrients for your garden, so you can put them into your green manure. If you have one of those composters, we have a rotating composter. It's not that big. It's maybe 2.5 feet across and about 1.5 feet deep, and it just has, it's up above the ground. It's on a stand, and you rotate it. And I put lots of worms in there so that they can do their really good job on composting the kitchen leftovers. But as much as I do that a little with the eggshells, most of the eggshells I contain, and we have one of our renters does a lot of baking, so she keeps all her eggshells for me, as does most people, and I use a potato masher to mash them up in a container. And I spread them both on top of the soil as well as going down about 4 or 5 inches. What those things will do, those shells, they will, if you have wireworms, slugs, cutworms, snails, a variety of different pathogens that you want, don't want in your soil, they will actually kill them. So that's a good thing. You want to get rid of the bad stuff and keep the good stuff. Another thing that you can do for your cabbage is actually put strips of newspaper around the cabbages, and that will protect them if you get cutworms. Can I think what else was it? We've got the herbs, we've got the vegetables, we've got the flowers, we've got the protectors, we've got the eggshells, we've got the newspaper. There's just so many things we can use naturally because you don't want to put those toxic sprays on your food. Now, when it gets really hot, you either need to harvest your cabbage before the heat gets hot or plant it during that time so that you can harvest it in the fall. The cabbage typically don't like really, really hot weather. Either that or put it in the shade or do the type of companion planting so that other plants are protecting it from the direct sunlight. If you leave it in the fall, so just after the first couple of light freezes, that will actually help increase the flavor of it, which is fantastic. You can do second cropping with cabbages. Just know that getting maybe 6 or 7 heads, but they'll be much smaller. Okay, and that works great for me. It's the second cropping that I use for the pickling and the fermenting. If you've got a leaf type of cabbage, so any of your bok choys or your savoy cabbage, for instance, make sure that you harvest them like you do lettuce. Take off the outer leaves first and allow it to keep growing from the inside out. Now, of course, remembering at the end of the year, you've got your cooking, your fermenting, your pickling. They're all different ways of freezing, of keeping cabbage throughout the winter. So if you've got a good harvest, that is a good thing. You'll be able to keep it. It just keeps in the fridge forever, for crying out loud, especially when it's really good, healthy cabbage. It tends to stay a long time just in the fridge. But you want it throughout the whole winter. It's a fantastic food. Like we said, it's got not only your vitamins and minerals, it has a broad range of bacteria that you want, and it has both your soluble and non-soluble fiber. So it's a really good food for your immune system, which we want to be strong, right? Remember, we go by the old theory, it's not the germ, it's the environment. You want to keep a good environment in your body to protect you from anything and everything. All right, so that's enough for the gardening. Let's now go to, here we are. The article today is on testing. Now, yes, we have an awful lot going on right now about all the different types of jabs that you can get, but I had a question come in about testing. There's all these different types of tests, Holly. Which test is the best test? So I thought, oh, okay. People don't want to just know PCR. They want to know all the different types of PCR. They want to know about the antibody testing, et cetera. We'll go through all of that for you today. And as usual, there's lots of references in the in my article so that you can go and look up the references, extend your research. As always, don't just depend on me. Get involved. This is your body, your health. Read both sides of the coin. Understand what you're doing. Find out what resonates with you and go from there. We say that every time. Okay, so let's look at the molecular testing. Molecular testing will include the PCR testing, which is the polymerase chain reaction. And there's a variety of them, so we'll go over a variety of different ones. Not all of them, but we'll go over the most commonly used ones. Then there's the viral RNA testing and the nucleic acid test. Now, they all look for some component of the RNA in the virus, supposedly. Now, I say supposedly because there's been lots of papers suggesting that when they put together the PCR testing for COVID-19, they actually took strands out of a gene bank and made it up. I can't prove that or disprove that, just putting that out there for you. Now, there's also all kinds of issues. We've talked about this many times, why PCR testing is a lousy test to use. Number one, we'll just quickly go over some of the highlights. Number one, PCR testing was designed for research, not for diagnostic purposes. The gentleman who designed it, when he got the Nobel Peace Prize, he said at best it was a poor theory. Now, having said that, that was back in 1993, I believe, and it has come a long way since then. But just because they have a lot of different ways of doing it now doesn't mean it's that much more accurate. Secondly, typically with the most common RPCR testing that is used, they use it at a cycling of 35 to 40. Well, it's meant to be used at a cycling of 17. So consequently, you end up with a lot of false positives. In fact, tests typically range between 80 and 90% false positives and false negatives 20% depending on how soon after the infection that you tested. And we'll actually get into that. One of the ones I love, and I can't remember what his name is, but I love the article. He went, researcher went into grocery stores in England and tested all the grocery in the produce, all the produce in the grocery store, and came out with 38% of the produce tested positive. That tells you something. Of course, we had last summer in China. That was the first one I saw. I had to laugh. Ice cream and mangoes tested positive. And it was three different flavors, vanilla, strawberry, and chocolate vanilla. Oh, well, so much for the ice cream. Okay, so what is the PCR testing? What happens is you get a swab. The swab is then mixed with a reagent, and then it is, in effect, cooked. It is heated. It is subjected to alternative temperature steps. So it's what's called a thermal cycler. It cycles between hot and cold, basically getting hydrotherapy if you're looking at natural medicine. And what that ends up doing is it creates billions of copies of the RNA so that the tester, the researcher, the analyzer can determine whether or not there's something there. It takes about 12 hours. Of course, that depends on how big the laboratory is and how many samples are being tested. But the false negatives will run about 20% after 5 days. But if it's earlier in the infection, it can run up to 100% false negatives. False positives tend to stand between 80 and 90%. Now, again, remember, you always want to look at the researcher. Who's funding the research? If it's Moderna funding their own research, their own laboratories, their own PCR testing, of course, the results are going to be significantly different than if it's someone who, a laboratory who's independent, not getting paid by Moderna, and doing an objective analysis. That is huge. We know how corrupt Western conventional medicine is, unfortunately, thanks to Big Pharma. If we would go back far enough, thanks to Rockefeller, because he's the one that took it over back in the 1920s, I believe it was, and eliminated all natural medicine, basically, and supported all universities that would come on board with him. And so now he makes a lot of money, as do the Rothschilds. So you want to look at who is funding the research. That is always an important thing. Now, in addition to that, you can look at, if you know research well enough, you can look at, was it the appropriate design? Was it the appropriate analysis? And, of course, was it the appropriate conclusion? All of which have been subjected to huge amount of corruption this past umpteen decades. We've gone over that many, many times. So again, if you're looking at jabs from Pfizer and Moderna, from J&J or from AstraZeneca, you don't want to look at those companies' research and analysis to find out if what is really going on. But in addition to that, you have to look at, say, you're going through a given laboratory that's doing it, a given university or another independent company, who are they being contracted by? Are the Modernas and the J&Js and the Pfizers, et cetera, are they contracting that research through the university, through the laboratory, through the other company? So, again, you need to find out if there's a conflict of interest going on. Okay, so then you have to look at the nasal swabs. And there's a lot of research suggesting that many of those nasal swabs are actually hollow and have a variety of things in them that you do not want in your body. It is very scary. If you're concerned about it, you need to be looking that up. The hydrogel that's used in the vaccines, for instance, a synthetic gel, it also can take anything into the body that they want to send it in. So if you want to call it deep state or the Illuminati or the cabal, whatever term that you tend to use, they call it on-demand delivery system. And that on-demand delivery system, as it says on the Moderna site, is like a Windows operating system that each time you get a jab, they can alter it. And, of course, that alters your DNA, your RNA, et cetera. I've given you a couple of really good references to watch or to read for that. Now, in addition to having the nasal swab test, you can also get a throat and saliva test. They tend to produce less false negatives than positives, but, again, we don't really know what's in them. Again, an interesting read on the PCR testing is given to you there. Now, nucleic acid testing is a form of molecular testing. It's the nucleic acids that either form the DNA or the RNA, depending on whether you're looking at a virus or a bacteria. Nucleic acid amplification test, the acronym for that is NAT, N-A-A-T, and it's, again, a type of PCR. Historically, I thought they were only being used in retroviruses as opposed to, now think about it, with the viruses you have, the influenzas A, B, and C, you have the retroviruses, the adenoviruses, and the coronaviruses. They've all been known for years and years and years and years, decades and decades and decades. In fact, it's well established that for every one of the trillion cells, is it 39 trillion cells you have in your body, I believe? obviously, that depends on the individual, but say on average 39 trillion cells, you have 10 to 1 bacteria just in your gut alone, 10 to 1 bacteria for every cell in your body. Now, think about the difference in bacteria and virus. If you take your hand to be the size of a bacteria, you take your, you know, quarter of your baby fingernail, and that's the size of a virus. So who knows how much virus we actually have in our body, because it's way, way more than the bacteria. I think it's 42% of our DNA is viral-driven. Just like we need all that good bacteria in our gut, we need lots of virus in the body for a lot of good reasons. Understand, when they're doing this, it's like, okay, guys, how many of those different viruses have the same RNA strand in them? Tons of them, crying out loud. So that's an issue. Another issue is that nucleic acid strand, whether they've taken it partly from a gene bank or not, it can be found in bacteria. It can be found in viruses. It can be found in your body. They cannot tell the difference between what's a dead RNA and what's a live RNA. So what value is it? Oh, my goodness. So let's go back to the NAT, which, again, a type of PCR testing used in retroviruses, but I think they are now using, I should look that up, I think they're also using it for the COVID-19 as well, assuming it's a real COVID-19. That's still up in question by many people. I can't prove it one way or the other. So what the NATs do is they draw from the respiratory tract, either the upper or the lower respiratory tract. But if we look at the CDC in the U.S., and I'm not sure about other countries around the world, they want testing only on the upper respiratory tract, which means it's the nasopharyngeal, the nasal mid-tuberate, or the anterior nasal. So one way or another, they're going in some aspect, the front, the middle, or the back of the nasal structure to get a swab. Now, the process can use different methods to amplify the nucleic acid identifying the virus. They can use what's called the RPCR, the TMA, the LAMP, the CRISPR, et cetera, and that should be an I, not an S. Not an O, but we'll go down further. The process amplifies and makes several copies of the actual genetic material that's in you. The claim is that these tests are highly sensitive and can detect relatively small amounts of COVID-19 and are less likely to produce false negatives. The opposition is that it will provide way too many false positives. Now, again, why? Well, because it can't differentiate between the live and the dead, because those RNA strands are in all kinds of viruses and bacteria and people regardless, even in chocolate ice cream. Going back to that a little bit. Okay, also, the NATs can be done at home. All right. The TMA, that stands for Transcription Medicated Amplification Test, and both that and the NSBA can use the isothermal amplification reactions. That means they're heated. They mimic the retroviral RNA replication. Both of them target RNA sequences but don't require the thermal cycling. So as much as they're being heated, they don't have to go from the hot to the cold to the hot to the cold. That's basically all you need to know. But there is an article there if you want to go more in depth in it. The LAMP stands for loop mediated, isothermal amplification. And that uses a saliva sample rather than a nasal sample. It doesn't require the thermal cycling. And that thermal cycler is quite an expensive piece of equipment, so it is a lot cheaper. It can be done on home, on site, in the hospital, at the airport, etc. And it has far better results, meaning it has significantly less false positives, although there is 1 in 5 false negatives. However, the higher the viral load, the more the accuracy. The LAMP4 is another system. It combines what we refer to as the loop-mediated isothermal amplification, that's the LAMP, with nanopore sequencing. It can analyze large volumes. It has similar results as the RT or the RPCR, and some swear by it and many don't. So I've given you an article on that. Now, the droplet digital or the DDPCR uses the nasal swabs and was created due to the fact that there were so many variables that could impact on the RPCR process. However, it cannot determine the viral load, and that's hugely important. Let's just think of a scale, say, from 1 to 10. And you need at least 5 out of 10 viral load in order for that to have an impact on you or for you to be able to transmit it to somebody else. Well, if the viral load is 1, 2, 3, or 4, it's of no use. Right, and the PCR can't determine that. The standard PCR that we're using or that they're using cannot test that. So the DD PCR can not determine the viral load, and it cannot determine between live and dead strands, but it can provide an accurate viral load. I should have put in there if the viral load is above 5. I didn't clarify that. If the viral load, if we use this scale of 1 to 10, is above 5, then it can produce an more accurate viral load from what I understand. So there's the reference for that. The clustered regularly interspaced short syndromic repeats. Wow, did you get all that? This type of DNA tests for sequences, but it's used typically for bacteria, not for viruses, because viruses are typically only RNA without the DNA, and the CRISPR needs to use the DNA. Then we have the next generational sequencing and the whole genome sequencing. Now, I like the whole genome sequencing if you're going to use any of these, because it is the whole genome. It's not just a strand of like 10 pieces that they've put together. It's the whole genome. The cost for the NGS has dropped significantly. The WGS provides a lot more information. However, both are difficult when managing large amounts of data, so they're not that effective when it comes to COVID-19 because of the amount of testing they're doing. And, of course, you're going to have higher numbers when you have higher testing. I mean, that just stands to reason. We all know that. Okay, now when we're looking at the N gene, the E gene, the ORF, LA/B gene, those are all just different components of the RNA strand that is being tested for using the PCR testing. The challenge is they can be found in all kinds of different things. So, again, are they of really any use? Because you're not differentiating between the different types of viruses. However, again, there's an article there for both of them. Cycle threshold, that's referring to the fact that when you, well, it's not referring to, The problem with it, let's put it that way, with cycle threshold, is that you can get a sample from one person that's negative one day and positive the next, or vice versa. It's not consistent. It doesn't indicate the severity, and there's a lot of variable discrepancy. The isothermal amplification, well, that differs from the PCR, and that has a constant temperature instead of the cycling, and there's several different ones available. So in summary, the results are usually ready within hours, depending on the demand. Those false negatives and false positives run anywhere between 20 and 100%, and the concern about is the major concern that I have with them is what else is in them. So when you're talking about PCR testing, you could be talking about any one of those. Do you know what you're getting? Do you know what they're doing? Do you know how it's being tested? Do you know what the false negatives and false positives are? Do you know how variable the results can be dependent on the laboratory and the volume that's going through? I mean, there's just so many issues. If you have a challenge with that, you can go into what's called the antigen testing. Now, antigens are what the body creates. So these, again, can be done at home. They test for protein fragments. Okay, so with an molecular testing, you're testing for mRNA or DNA. With antigen tests, you're testing for antigens or spike proteins. It's similar to a pregnancy test. It's well been used, obviously, for years and years and years, if you consider that it's basically the same as a pregnancy test. The results are available within minutes. Now, this is the one I would use in terms of for the best safety results, but it has a higher false negative result. Lateral flow antigen tests are both cheap and quick, only often become positive after a few days. So you need to have several days of the pathogen in your system before it will test accurately. Consequently, there's a lot more false positives. It is quicker, it is less expensive, but has a lot more false negatives. Okay, and again, there's the reference for it. Now, the antibody test is a little different again. These tests are looking for the antibodies that your body is created in reaction to the infection, okay? So it's more effective when you're looking at past infections. It's a blood test that identifies the antibodies that your immune system has already generated. So it's not good for early accuracy testing. And it needs more time for the body to produce the antigens. Consequently, there's a lot more false negatives. In summary, ineffective for current identification or whether it is even still contagious, only that you have been exposed to it at some point in time. So it may test positive if you had it like 20 years ago or you were around someone that had it 20 years ago and your body created the antigens. So in a conclusion, what is the best test? Well, who knows? There is very poor evidence to suggest that any of the measures are effective and accurate. How many issues are involved in accurate detection? Well, there's all kinds of issues. How it was collected, how it was stored, poor short-term and even poor long-term analysis when it comes to accuracy. Different processes, different laboratories all have their own issues. And as always, do they really even have the right sequencing for the COVID-19? So the bottom line, no, there is no long gold standard. There's no long-term studies. There's no objective independent analysis. So personally, I don't trust the PCR testing. We know why and how it's so inaccurate, but also because we don't know what's in it. The antigen tests are not readily available, and the antibody tests are more about past infections. Of all of them, I would go with the antigen if I could. If I had a choice and had to go for a test, I would go for the antigen. Now, I've given you two, I think, is it just one? Oh, this one's just one, that's right. I've given you a reference there to learn how the Rockefellers went about eliminating real medicine and implementing synthetic medicine. So if you want to read that one, that's a really good article on it. I've also given you a number of other articles. A couple of them are really, really technical, but if you're really into science and love the technicality, you will enjoy them. The other ones are written for the layperson. So enjoy an idea of what's going on in your body, to make sure that you are doing the right thing for you. Again, I don't like I don't like telling people what to do, number one. I like people to know that they have choice, and I like them to do their own research and deal with what resonates with them. Okay? So that's the article for today. So the last thing we have is questions, and these questions, I think, actually stem from 2 weeks ago. We did one or two questions a couple weeks ago and then a couple more last week, and now we have these ones, remaining ones for this week. So let's find out what they are. Okay, we have Wanda in the UK. I have been having cravings for huge amounts of salt in recent months, and I've never been a salt person before. Could this be indicating a health concern? Well, there's a number of causes for craving salt, but let's clarify what salt. We have the table salt, which is just simply man-made sodium chloride. We have sea salt, which is way, way better. And we have Himalayan salt, that if it's a good Himalayan salt, is 10 times better. Yeah. The Himalayan salt has all the minerals, including the trace minerals that we need. So I always suggest get your Himalayan salt. I tend to see, if you look at Ayurvedic medicine, my dosha process tends to be depleted in minerals. So I use a lot of Himalayan salt. The challenge is I've never really cooked with salt before. So I don't know, a couple decades, how many decades ago when I found out I was always depleted in minerals, I started using the Himalayan salt. There's only certain things I'll put salt on. So corn on the cob, which is ironic because we don't have the enzymes to digest corn on the cob, but I love it anyways, and I will put Himalayan salt on it. Tomatoes. I love fresh tomatoes. And if you can gather from our articles, I love lots of tomatoes. We have a ton of different tomato plants in the garden, different varieties. We have both the determinate and the indeterminate. We have the cherry to the beefsteak, everything in between. I love fresh tomatoes with Himalayan salt on them. The challenge with that is you actually get more out of a tomato if you cook it because we don't have the enzymes again to break it down. The other thing, again, is kind of interesting, is popcorn. I put lots of Himalayan salt on popcorn. Now, again, we don't have the enzymes to digest corn. So if you're eating canned corn, frozen corn, corn on the cob, we don't have the enzymes to digest that. But if you buy organic popcorn and you pop it in, say, avocado oil or coconut oil, and I do use the coconut oil for that, and then put your Himalayan salt on it, now you're getting all your minerals, you're getting fats, you're getting fibers, it's just a really good healthy food. And because the corn kernel has already popped open, you don't have to worry about breaking it down. And now you've got fiber for all those wonderful bacteria that you want to get to the right place in your gut. Okay, so it can cause a desire for salt. Well, dehydration can. Dehydration will also cause dizziness and headaches and rapid heart rate, muscle cramps and spasms. That's my big thing. I get muscle cramps and spasms. I have my whole life and on a regular basis, like 2-3 times a week. And so that's, actually I don't do that anymore. I used to. That's probably because I take magnesium supplements and eat a lot more of the Himalayan salt. It can be an electrolyte imbalance. For that, you tend to have, as well, headaches, nausea, vomiting, confusion. Oh, excuse me, maybe fatigue. If you have stress or adrenal issues, and now note that the adrenals respond to both psychological and physiological stress, people who have high levels of sodium release lower levels of cortisol during stressful periods. But that could be indicative of needing more salt. Addison's disease, now that's an adrenal issue. You tend to have a severe lack of energy, loss of appetite, weight loss, dark skin patches, mouth sores in the cheeks, and pale, clammy skin. Barter syndrome is also indicative. That's when your body can't reabsorb sodium. So when the kidneys take it out of the blood and it goes into the Lupa Henle, you need to reabsorb it to keep your levels regulated. But with Barter syndrome, you can't do that. So you're chronically low in your sodium levels, and that will also reflect in low blood pressure, muscle weakening, cramping, constipation, and kidney stones. Pregnancy can also demand more salt, especially if there's vomiting and diarrhea and then dehydration. PMS, for menstrual swings, if you have also mood swing, loss of sleep and food cravings, that could also be causing your craving for salt. So those, as I always say, I'm not giving you every one of the possibilities. I'm giving you the most common possibilities. Okay? All right. Ariel in New York. The whites in my eyes don't look clear and bright like they usually do. What could cause that? Is it anything serious? Well, that depends on the cause. The first one I always think of would be jaundice, the liver, gallbladder. It could also be the pancreas. Your liver and spleen break down your red blood cells after about 90 to 120 days. The byproduct is bilirubin. That bilirubin goes down with the bile salts through your gallbladder and back into your intestines, and that actually gives you the color of your intestine. If you are not eliminating it along with the bile salts, then what happens is your stool gets to get lighter and lighter. So your stool should be a medium to a dark brown. If it's getting into a light brown, a yellowy brown, a gray brown is really bad, a gray color, that's telling you your liver is not functioning well. It's a very simple way to always check your stools to make sure your stools are healthy. If the color is lighter and lighter, that means it's a liver issue. That means that the liver is not breaking down your red blood cells. And that could be an indicator that you have something like jaundice, which is causing the yellowness in your eyes. You could also have a non-alcoholic fatty liver or an alcoholic fatty liver. You could have toxins and inflammation in your liver. You could have viruses in your liver like hepatitis A or B. And those could also cause the yellow in your eyes. So you might want to consider doing a major liver cleanse. Make sure you have a healthy colon, do a colon cleanse before you do a liver cleanse. And then eat lots of bitter foods to help support the liver. Drink your dandelion tea. That'll be good for you. Take milk thistle to provoke the rebuilding of your liver. Foods that are good for the liver include, what do they include? Well, we got your dandelion and green tea. Actually, I think the dandelion tea is even better than the green tea for your liver. Grapefruit decreases the group P450 enzymes in your liver, which are required to metabolize many drugs. So with the grapefruit, there could be an interaction with the drugs if you're taking pharmaceutical drugs. On the other hand, you may want to increase your grapefruit and decrease your drug. Grapefruit also provides antioxidants as well as various other liver components. Now, for the liver, just remember a general rule of thumb. If it's a bitter, it's good for your liver. Okay? Blueberries and cranberries provide lots of antioxidants and polyphenols, anthocyanins, had to think there for a minute, which is also found in chocolate, that help to keep your liver healthy. What else keeps your liver healthy? Beetroot juice, antioxidants. It has healthy nitrates. It has loads of betalains, which not only benefit the heart, but reduce inflammation, work against a load of cancers. In the liver, they provide antioxidants for the free radicals. I had to stop and think, what am I saying there? And they actually help to support the detoxification enzymes. Now, Mom was right. Those vegetables that so many kids don't like your Brussels sprouts, your broccoli, your mustard greens, they all improve the detox enzymes in the liver and prevent liver damage. Now, again, your liver also needs the good healthy fats, not the bad fats, the good healthy fats. So all your anti-inflammatory foods, your fish, steelhead trout as opposed to salmon. Avocados, fantastic. Remember, avocados have the same ratio of omega-3, 6, and 9 that your body has, virtually the same. So avocados are really, really good for you, both avocado and coconut oil. Flaxseed and chia seeds, they're all fantastic for your liver. Keep your liver healthy. Remember, your liver is the largest internal organ. Obviously, your skin is the largest organ. But it not only is the largest internal organ, it does over 500 functions. It supports every other system and process and organ in your body. Remember, the nutrients from the gut, from your intestines, which is actually a tube, so if you go into the tube, you're outside the body, all that nutrient has to get from that tube into the portal blood and into your liver so that your liver can do something with it. So you need, not only do you need a really good healthy gut, you need a really good healthy liver. Okay? So if your eyes are yellowing, that's usually a liver issue. I've given you a number of different types of liver issues that may be incorporated into that or being caused by that. Of course, glutathione is huge. Glutathione is your major detoxification compound in the body. Does more than any other compound in the body. If you've listened to me over the years, you know glutathione is my favorite compound in the body because it's involved in so many different things. And if you're not producing sufficient glutathione, you're not detoxing properly. Now, glutathione is highest concentration in the liver, second highest concentration is in the eyes. Again, could be contributing to the yellowing in the eyes. Okay? So when I look at yellowing eyes, those are the things that I would be looking at. Seen in California, poor California. Right now we're thinking that California not only drought and fires, but everybody leaving because they don't like what's happening in California. Wow. Francine is saying, I was thinking of doing a cleanse for spring. I was wondering what Dr. Holly recommends for a good type of cleanse. Well, I love cleanses that are natural and that you don't have to go and buy and do a whole bunch of different things for because I like things nice and simple. In Ayurvedic medicine, it would depend on your dosha, so whether you're Vata, Pitta, Kapha, or some combination. In Western medicine, or alternative medicine, I guess I should qualify, real medicine, let's put it that way, what I would suggest as a standard is a castor oil cleanse. Okay, so what you do is you make sure you're going to be home the next morning. In the evening before, you warm up a cup of milk. Now, I don't care whether it's cattle milk, whether it's goat milk, coconut milk, almond milk, you just need a cup of milk. And you put in a tablespoon of castor oil, and you drink that last thing before you go to bed. Then in the morning, you do that again. And then you just drink fluids until you eliminate. Now, if you have a plugged up colon that's not effective, you may have to do that a couple of times. I've actually had people, it took them 3 or 4 times before they actually got a good release. If it's somewhat healthy, then you should get a really good release the next day. Once you've had your good elimination, then you can start eating foods again. And I would suggest for that day, eat soft, easy soups and what have you that are easy for the colon. That allows for a good colon cleanse. Now, in Ayurvedic medicine, some of them, in some areas, suggested that you should do that on a weekly basis. Some said on a monthly basis. Some would say between the seasons. Whichever way you decide to do it, it's a really good, effective, simple way of cleansing out. And we do it probably once a month, I would say. But every body is different. Your climates are different. Your environments are different. Make sure that you have an organic castor oil. You want a good one, not full of toxins, but it should clean you out fairly quickly. Okay? All right. That's it for today. So I'm Dr. Holly with the Whole Health Initiative. My business is Choices Unlimited for Health and Wellness. You can go to my website. I have finally completed that 984 articles. I had to copy, file, and save each one of them individually. We have finally done that, so we're going to move forward on the website. Geez, we've been saying that forever. It's taken me forever to get that done, but we finally finished it. Holy cow. But in the meantime, you can still access the website. It, like I said, has like over 900 articles on it. It has a number of videos, especially when it comes to depression. It can send you to my other sites for books like drhollybooks.com. I still have 12 books I need to get published. I'm way behind on everything. I spend too much time in the garden because I love gardening. So we have, I think there's 20 books online. There's another 12 books to go, and I'm working on another 3 books. Eventually we'll get that all done. It also sends you to other radio shows and different things that you can get lots of good free information. The books can be downloaded using a number of different protocols, so they're all cheap. Do what you can. And don't forget, Nicole is fantastic at archiving everything. So with my program and all the other programs, I'm sure she's got all the sessions archived, so you can go into those and look up tons and tons and tons of information as well. Okay? So I'm Dr. Holly with Choices Unlimited for Health and Wellness, giving you the Full Health Initiative for May 12th. And I want you to have a great week. I want you to thrive. I want you to think healthy, eat healthy, work healthy, be healthy. And we will talk with you again next week. Take good care. Bye-bye now.
Hear all of our previously aired broadcasts of News for the Soul online at newsforthesoul.com. Now let's get back to the show.